Hello, welcome to Growing Wild. I'm Charlotte Petz and you're listening to Radio Reverb on 97.2 FM, online and on digital. On this month's show, we get a little bit political. So we'll be hearing from Rupert Reed of Extinction Rebellion, Sarah Venn of Incredible Edible, and a few voices from Wildflower Lewis. But first of all, we know how this goes. We're going to have a song, and it's Here Comes Your Man by the Pixies. Here Comes Your Man by the Pixies. It's a good song. Okay, so having compiled the highlight show at the end of last year, which has played out for longer than expected, apologies, what seemed quite striking to me was just this rumbling, this kind of increase of just this feeling of unrest and realising that leaving a lot of decisions and allowing the pace of change to be set by the government just isn't enough. It's not moving quickly enough. And as regards to the decline in the numbers of wildlife, in climate change, you know, there's some big things happening and there's not enough being done about it, seems to be the view. So it's almost like the government are distracted or something. I don't know what with. So I wanted to speak to a few people who seem to be taking these matters more into their own hands. And the first and probably most radical of the three interviews I've got coming up is Extinction Rebellion. They're a relatively new movement. You may have heard of them from the mass protest they held in London, where they blocked off lots of the major bridges around London just by being on them and having a presence there and sort of blocking all of the traffic. So I wanted to find out a bit more about that organisation and why it feels like it just seems a bit different to previous things that have come and gone. I spoke to Rupert Reed and started by asking him just to explain a little bit more about Extinction Rebellion.
Extinction Rebellion is a new movement for non-violent direct action in defence of the planet and specifically to try to stop other species from going extinct. They're going extinct at an absolutely massive rate. We're in the middle of the sixth mass extinction, which is caused by human beings, and to stop the possibility of ourselves going extinct down the line. We're in rebellion against governments, and that's basically all governments, which are taking patently inadequate measures to avoid these horrendous extinctions. We're trying to change the way that we operate absolutely radically, but without resorting to the methods used by those who have oppressed and messed us up. Part of the point is that we're hoping that by way of putting ourselves on the line, putting our bodies on the line, putting our careers on the line, etc., will inspire a mass amount of sympathy. And that's really quite important because, of course, public opinion isn't necessarily fully up to speed or with the program in terms of the extinction crisis and the climate crisis. One of the things that we need to do is get more of the public on our side, and we think that it's possible to do that if we show that we're willing to really lead, put our money where our mouths are, put our bodies where our mouths are. And if there's a lot of very well-intentioned and decent people who are being arrested, being sent to prison, that kind of thing, that's a classic way that nonviolent movements in the past have taken the high ground. And in that sense, we're seeking to follow in the footsteps of Martin Luther King, of Gandhi, of the suffragettes, and of many more, of course. And started to find a way around the apparently implacable power of the state.
Mm. Do you think the image is finally changing then? It's coming away from I think, unfortunately, there is a bit of an image of kind of green protests being a bit extremist, a bit sort of hippie, maybe. Do you think that this is now reaching the more mainstream because of what you said earlier about how it's now sort of humans now facing extinction? Are more people waking up to this now because, unfortunately, humans need to be a bit more immediacy in their own situation being threatened to actually start taking notice?
With climate change, with dangerous climate change at least, there is now a growing awareness, even in the United States, that this is essentially an anthropogenic problem, that it is really serious. This awareness is penetrating to more younger people. And this is a key reason why the time for this movement is now. In many ways, obviously, we really needed this a few years ago, or 10 years ago, or 20 years ago. But it perhaps couldn't happen until we started to get the crazy weather of the last few years, for example, which has woken a lot of people up. Now, in terms of the image of the movement, this means, because it's becoming more of a mass consciousness around this, this does mean that we're starting to get away from certain kinds of stereotypes that you mentioned of what a green campaigner looks like. What you were getting at is that the association of being green with a certain kind of hippie kind of way of life can be a problem in terms of mainstreaming what we're doing. Now, in this connection, I think it's quite important that the Extinction Rebellion seems to have a somewhat wider appeal than, for example, mainstream green NGOs have tended to do. And that's very interesting, because the Extinction Rebellion is a very, very radical movement. What the Extinction Rebellion seems to have done is it's brought together a somewhat diverse group of people. There are academics involved. There are hippie-type people involved, sure. There are definitely some working class people involved. I've been very struck by that, and that I have to mention that, because that is a contrast to some green organizations and movements in the past. When I was on Lambeth Bridge, for example, in the huge, amazing bridges protest a few months ago now in London, where we took these bridges and held them for several hours as in a mass nonviolent direct action, the diverse class base of the people who were there was very striking. There were plenty of working class people, plenty of middle class people. It was really quite diverse. So, yeah, I think that there is something encouraging there in the way that Extinction Rebellion seems to be breaking out somewhat, at least, beyond usual demographics.
Yeah, that is what I was getting at. It's trying to understand how come this one's so different, because it feels very different. It looks very different. You've mentioned a few little nuggets there about the situation we're in with biodiversity and climate. Can you paint a picture from how you view that? What do you see is happening to the planet, and where is it at in terms now, for you to be taking this action?
We are the cause of an unprecedented die-off of non-human life. That half the wildlife on the planet has gone in the last 40 years, an absolutely astonishing and horrendous statistic, that the sixth mass extinction crisis, unlike all the others preceding it, is being caused by one species, namely ourselves. And it really is time to, past time, to wake up to these terrible facts and to start to change our ways. And that has to mean much more than kind of reformist politics or reformist environmentalism as usual. We've tried demonstrating and writing letters and voting and so on. Now we have to carry on doing all those things, especially voting and standing for election, which, in my opinion, as someone who's also in the Green Party, is absolutely crucial. But to think that those things at this desperate juncture are going to be enough by themselves is to think in a clearly inadequate way. So now is a time to up the ante considerably, to be freed from our assumption that politics as usual is going to potentially save us, to be freed from ideas of staking everything in our own personal lives on career advancement and pensions and buying a house and so on. None of this is going to mean anything. None of this is going to be possible if we don't get the biodiversity crisis and the climate crisis under control. So that's really at the core of the message. And the idea is it's time to rise up. It's time to rise up to become equal to this challenge. And it's an unprecedented, terrifying, and hugely exciting or awe-inspiring time of responsibility for humanity. And that means for every single one of us. There's no avoiding this.
Yeah, it's quite a time to be alive, isn't it? I think
absolutely.
We all need to play our part now.
It's very easy at this time to feel unlucky to be landed with such responsibility or to have such fears that you have to grapple with. I don't know about you, Charlotte, or listeners, but I certainly sometimes get terrible dreams about drought, about fire, about Trump, about post-apocalyptic scenarios.
Trump features in my dreams more than I would ever wish.
Yeah,
to
absolutely.
Have yeah.
And then the flip side of that, as we are saying, is that if we actually rise to this challenge, if we are willing to face up to this awesome and terrible reality and the even worse reality that will follow if we don't face up to it, then what a great time to be alive, an extraordinary time to be able to do something absolutely amazing and historic.
It's a problem on so many different layers, because I think humans, just as a species, we're very short-sighted and we're quite absorbed in our own little worlds, and it's what affects us directly, you know. And unfortunately, we do focus on getting a house, kind of protecting our own, making sure we're safe. And it's how we change that. It's how we change those people's minds. You know, how do you get... I don't really expect you to know the answer to this. But it seems to be the question. It's sort of, how do we infiltrate that mindset and make it so that people can see, no, that's not what is important. And it's all this other stuff.
Yeah.
It's the underlying... I think on your website it says that interdependence of life must underpin everything. You know, it's sort of understanding that we're not separate and things aren't lesser than us. It's changing those minds that I feel like, how do you do that? You know, how does that start happening? Because it's all right preaching to the converted, but it's beyond that, you know?
Yes. So there's a number of aspects there. Firstly, I'd say on preaching to the converted is very important. One of the things that one needs to do is precisely to preach to the converted, to try to convert the converted into doing more about what they already know.
Okay.
Right?
So it's partly upping what they already know and saying, like,
yeah, and empowering people and getting people to realize that we can do extraordinary things together. And that's one of the key points.
Mm.
And another aspect of this also, in terms of us being in this together, is that a lot of the sort of practical response, insofar as there's a kind of practical local response here, has to be community oriented. So I say to people, look, by all means, stockpile some food in your own loft and some candles and so on against the possibility of hard times to come. But don't be under any illusion that that's going to get you very far at all. If we're going to survive, let alone flourish through this, we have to do it together. We need to learn how to grow our own food and to do that together. As communities and as areas, because if you've got enough food and your neighbors haven't, well, that's an unstable situation. We need to do this together. This is what I keep on saying, because it's important enough to bear a lot of repeating.
Mm.
Another key aspect of what you're talking about works at a kind of higher level, which is a level that I also work at, like the more general idea of endless progress and of endless so-called development. Now, when you challenge the idea of endless progress, people think, well, what are you saying? We all have to go back into caves or something? No, of course we're not saying that. What we're saying is, so long as you think that what life is about is human beings expanding more and more their so-called control over nature, expanding more and more their industry, expanding more and more without any clear point to it, and sometimes their knowledge, then you're thinking in the kind of way that's got us into the problem that we're in. Of course, we need to use sound science, climate science, obviously, for example, ecology more generally, to deal with the problem that we're in. But the idea that what we ought to be doing is trying to predict and control and know everything more and more forever is an absurd idea.
Mm.
It's a hubristic idea. It's an idea that, as you were implying, I think, Charlotte, tacitly places human beings as if we're above and separate from and better than everything else. We have to go back to a somewhat more humble idea of ourselves. We are one species among very many. We depend upon a network of life which is far bigger than us and which we're never going to know fully. We're never going to be able to predict and control the world fully. The fantasy of kind of huge techno fixes that will save us is a fantasy of being able to predict and control the entire world, which is a very dangerous fantasy.
Mm.
We ought to be more humble. We ought to be more precautious. We ought to use the precautionary principle. We ought to be more ethical in our engagements, obviously. with other animals in particular. And if we start to make those kind of changes, and if we start to challenge the hegemony of ideas such as endless economic growth, endless so-called progress, endless so-called development, then we're in a position to actually start to look to the basis, the imaginary, as we're, some of us are calling it now, of a new civilization, of a new, better, lighter, more humble way of living on the earth. And that is the only way that we're going to get through this coming vast crisis with any kind of dignity and, frankly, with any kind of future.
So there we go. That was Rupert Reed of Extinction Rebellion. I feel like it echoed quite a lot. That last bit especially echoed quite a lot of the interview I did with Mac McCartney a couple of shows back. And it's just, it's that thing of zooming out and seeing that we are part of an interconnected land and landscape, and it's finding our role within it and not being so dominating all the time. How we unravel that mindset is going to be fascinating, because it's sort of necessary, I think. Okay, let's have a song, and then we're going to hear from Sarah Venn, who's a bit of a food activist. This is Capitalist Blues by Layla McCalla.
Get higher. I've got the capitalist blues.
That's Capitalist Blues by Layla McCalla. Okay, so now we're going to hear from Sarah Venn. She is a food activist. She's part of something called Incredible Edible. She's gardened and grown for pretty much her whole life. And she's someone who's quite vocal out on social media and especially Twitter. And she's a really interesting person to follow. And so she's been on my radar for quite a while, actually. And I thought she'd fit really nicely with this show. So I caught up with Sarah. She's based down in Bristol. And I started out by asking her to explain a little bit more about what Incredible Edible is.
So, Incredible Edible is a worldwide movement that began in West Yorkshire in 2008, where we come together as groups within a community from a real kind of grassroots aspect, and without necessarily asking for permission or whatever, we find sort of bits and pieces of public land that are probably quite lost and unloved, and clean them up and turn them into beautiful and productive gardens.
Well,
or at least that's certainly what we do in Bristol. There's over 700 groups worldwide. Everybody does something slightly differently, but it's all based around the premise of constantly spinning what we call our three plates, which are community, business, and learning. So you're constantly kind of supporting local business, working with communities, creating a kinder way forward, and sharing skills that we might be losing as we kind of go into a future of being slightly unsure of our food system.
Just slightly unsure, aren't we, at the moment?
Yeah.
So how do these gardens come about? I mean, do people approach you? Do they say, hey, look, we've got this space?
But lots of sort of groups, it's very much a case of, they come together, they find a space, they get on with it. In Bristol, obviously, we are a massive city of 455,000 people, so we do things slightly differently, in that what we do is we sit back and we kind of wait for people to come to us with an idea. And what they basically say is, we've got an idea. And what we don't do is we don't do it for them. We support them to do it.
Okay.
So it becomes a proper community space rather than just something where somebody's helicoptering in every 2 weeks and gardening. So that can look like support with speaking to people about land use issues. It can be around, you know, getting how do they get and maintain volunteers, or it, you know, it can be around social media. It can be around horticulture is one thing. We get a lot of people who come to us and they go, we've got this space, we've got this idea, we'd really like to do this, but none of us have ever grown anything. So you know, we do a whole lot of that with them, and then you know, as they become more confident, we kind of back away and go on to the next people.
And what do you see happen in those spaces? I know one particularly, because I've been to Bristol a few times, so I've got some friends there, as you tend to in Brighton. Brighton and Bristol are quite interchangeable.
Yes, we are quite linked.
Yes. The Bear Pit.
Yes.
I know it, I've walked through it, and I've seen it transform over the over the years. What have you seen happen there? You know, how is that? How has that space transforming helped the people that are engaged with it and people using that space?
So there's this real thing, isn't there, that people don't think that they have the capacity or the power to make any change.
Mm.
And lots of people think that they have to kind of, you know, you have to get written permission in triplicate from goodness only knows where in order to do something. But the reality is you really don't. Now, I'm not suggesting at all that everybody guerrilla gardens everywhere, but actually, you know, most places aren't going to say no to you improving somewhere.
Mm.
So, you know, I think with all of the gardens, I mean, specific, you know, particularly the Bear Pit, because the Bear Pit is quite, it's quite extreme.
Mm. It was quite scary. I found it a little bit scary. Yeah.
Yes, it can be. But you know, suddenly you've got this horrible space that you're turning into something that is primarily beautiful, and I think that that's something that we really focus on. So yes, it's really great that we're growing food in the city centre, etc., etc. But what's really important, if we want to make this a movement for real change that isn't just something that, you know, people go, oh, that's lovely, bless them, is actually making beautifully designed, stunning spaces that people want to be in.
Yeah.
And I think that that's very much the difference. You know, we always make sure there's somewhere to sit. We always make sure that, you know, there's a bit of shade under a tree. There's, we think really hard about what it's going to look like and how that's appropriate for that environment, and also how that's appropriate for the group of people who are, you know, who are doing the project. So I mean, we always have this conversation with people. They come to us, they go, we want to do this. 9 times out of 10 they're going, oh, we kind of want it to look like an allotment space, but we don't really know what that means. And you know we do quite a lot of working with people around, well, how much time have you really got for this? You know, let's make it as stress-free for you as possible, because what we really want of these spaces is that they are properly sustainable moving forward.
Mm.
Because again, it's that thing where, you know, if you give people you leave people with a whole load of work to do, they're just going to go, at some point they're going to go, oh God, this is just too much of a nightmare, and we're going to just give up. But what we actually need to see is a complete change in people's minds, where they go, oh yeah, look, we can do this.
Yeah.
And it's not that much work, but we can make a real change to what is going on outside our own front doors.
That seems to be the key. It's making people realise that actually that individual, you can make a difference. Mm. And it's not, it's exactly that.
Yeah.
And igniting that realisation in people. It seems to be the important bit. Yeah, yeah, and it's sort of facing up to our own responsibilities in a way.
Absolutely.
We're all responsible. It's not someone else's responsibility to sort space out. It's kind of ours.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And you know, that might not be particularly comfortable for some people.
No.
But, you know, if you want to see a better world, you've got to make it yourself.
Very true. I read an article that you wrote for Bloom magazine. And you quoted in there something that Ron Finley had said about gardening in the cities, the most political act you can do. Why do you think that?
So, I mean, it's such a complex
conversation. It's a big question, I know.
But, you know, that whole thing of, you know, what we do is we support people to grow food in the middle of the city or by the sides of, you know, roads, and you'll get loads of people go, oh, no, that's not safe. It really is. We make sure it is.
Yeah.
So it's fine.
There's a lot of fear, isn't there? It feels like you have to overcome quite a lot of
fear.
There
is a whole load of fear. Yeah. There's a whole load of mythology.
Yeah.
That, of course, is utter, you know, most of it is utter rubbish. You know, if you plant a, you know, if you plant an apple tree, you know, kids will just throw the apples around. Well, they might. You know, yes, they very well might. But also, somebody might actually eat an apple.
Mm.
So you know, I mean, it is political, because what you're actually saying is we don't like what we see, so we're doing something about it. It's political with a little p, which just basically means it's people taking control. And I know we've heard that phrase quite a lot lately. It makes me quite nervous to say it. but, you know, it is that thing of people just going, oh, I have got a voice. I can make some change. I mean, you know, the thing about Incredible Edible is it's not about self-sufficiency. It's not about, you know, saying, oh, if we turn all of our streets over to food growing, we can be, you know, we don't need to worry.
Mm.
It's about saying, actually, this is a different way. It's about saying our streets don't need to be full of boring landscaping plants that are badly managed.
There's a lot of talk at the moment because the globalisation of food and how mm-hmm. What impact that has on the environment, and it's a huge conversation at the moment.
Yeah.
Meat eating and the vegan diet is a huge thing at the moment. It seems to be really kicking off at the minute.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of people saying, well, we need to bring it back down to a more local level. Mm-hmm. If we can all grow our own food, then what's the problem? But there's... What are your thoughts on that? Because
okay.
I don't know that it's a bit of a dream world if that works, but there's a lot of privilege in there and all sorts of things. So what's your...
I mean, it's so complex. I think that's the first thing to be really clear on.
Mm. That it's not a black and white answer, is it? It's not a this or that.
There is no right and there is no wrong. And everything's become horribly divisive. And there's people over here shouting at people over here. And, you know, and I just think, actually, we need to really focus on what this is about. It's about making sure that people get the nutrition that they need.
It's such a big thing. It's such a big question. The more I talk about it, the more I sort of think, ah!
It's enough to blow your brain.
It really does. It really does, yeah. But then I guess going back to what we were saying at the beginning, just trying to bringing it back down to the level at which we can actually handle it, because I think this is what we can all do, is go too many steps forward and think, well, it's too big, I can't handle it, I can't do anything about that, that's out of my reach. So it's keep bringing the problem back down to a more personal level.
Yeah.
And think, well, what actually can I do? And then it is the small things, it's improving the space around you. It is, you know, it is growing some of your own stuff and teaching
absolutely.
People how
and I mean,
to do
everybody
that.
Can grow something, but not everybody can grow everything. I think that's the important message.
Yeah, I think
you know, everybody can grow, I don't know, a tomato plant or some herbs on their windowsill, or you know.
Do you think that realization in itself, that like, oh, this is how this grows. Oh, look, I can do this. Do you think that can lead to just better choices if you are shopping in the supermarket? You think, oh, so, I'll go for a whole food because I understand that that's really nutritious in that, you know.
So let me tell you a tale. You'll like this one. We were working in an area that is quite deprived last year, and we were doing quite a lot of work with a young lad who was about 10 and who was absolutely convinced he was going into the army. That's what he'd been told that he was going to do. That was his life sort of set out in front of him. And he had come along to some Saturday morning sessions. And you know when you just meet somebody and you go, yeah, you just get this. This is brilliant. And he'd asked a whole load of really intelligent questions whilst at the same time telling me that he was a low achiever. Actually using those words about himself, it was heartbreaking. And after about 3 sessions, he said to me, Sarah, can I ever do this as a job? Would this ever be a job? And I just looked at this lad and I was like, well, what do you think a farmer is? So I think we have removed food and food growing and agriculture from our kids to such a degree they don't even realise it's an option.
That was me. You know, I didn't know. And I really never thought, it didn't occur to me until I was in my late 20s. And then I was like, oh, this is a thing.
I can do this.
People work
so
in this
I
industry.
Just, I just think that there's so much education needed at such a young level.
Mm.
because these kids all seem to think that they're going to be social media stars, influencers, or the Kardashians, and they're not going to be any of those things. You know,
they're going to be hungry. That's what
they're going to be hungry. And in 20 years' time, our job market is going to look so different to what it looks like now. And you know, we're going to need people in green technology. We're going to need people in agriculture. We're going to need plant scientists because, you know, the natural world is dying around us and we need to sort that out.
That was Sarah Venn there of Incredible Edible. We covered quite a lot of ground in that, and we went on quite a bit longer about that situation of the globalisation of food and all of that stuff. But it feels like it raises, and it always does this, it raises more questions than there are answers. But that's, I guess, what makes it interesting, because we're kind of all in this together. We've got to work this out together. And how we untangle something that's become so global to becoming less impactful on the environment and bringing it all back down to a more local scale, but ensuring that everyone gets fed and that everyone has enough. Holy moly, it's a big problem. And I don't envy our MPs having to work that out. But maybe it's up to all of us to help work that out as well. And that's what I feel like these people are all trying to do. It's like we've got to stand up and take our place and take responsibility, because it's not going to be someone else's problem for much longer. It's kind of our problem. Oh, that was a bit ranty, wasn't it? Let's have a song, and then we're going to hear from Wildflower Lewis. But first up, this is Harry Nilsson and Gotta Get Up.
Gotta get up, gotta get out, gotta get home before the morning comes. What if I'm late? Got a big day, gotta get home before the sun comes up. Up and away, got a big day, sorry I can't stay. I gotta run, run, yeah. Gotta get home, pick up the phone, gotta let the people know I'm gonna be late.
That's Harry Nilsson and Gotta Get Up. Okay, so finally we're going to hear from a group called Wildflower Lewis. I went along to something called Seedy Saturday, which is in Lewis. You've probably heard of Seedy Sunday. It's featured an awful lot on this show. It's an annual event in February, first weekend of February. And that's the one that takes place in Brighton. And it was the original one, and it's where you can go and get your seeds for the season. And that in itself is actually quite a political thing, because saving your seeds and passing them on instead of allowing the bigger companies to be in charge of the seeds that we grow and the heritage of that. We've covered that before. I won't get into that. So I went along to this other seed swap in Lewis, and it was Seedy Saturday. And there was a talk there by somebody called Imogen Makepeace, who is a Green Party councillor. And they were talking about a project that she was part of called Wildflower Lewis. And they've made some significant changes in the last year. And it seems quite small, but actually these things make a big difference. And essentially it was lobbying the town council to just reduce the amount of times that verges get cut to allow the natural growth of the wildflowers that are in there. So instead of cutting these things kind of six times a year, they now only get cut twice a year. I ended up speaking to four different people, and they're all going to introduce themselves. Three of them are from Wildflower Lewis, and then Dan Danahar, who is going to be starting to work with them this year. They all introduce themselves. They've all got quite distinctive voices, so hopefully you can tell who's speaking at any one time. So this is the crew from Wildflower Lewis.
I'm Leslie Healy. I'm the secretary of Wildflower Lewis.
Imogen Makepeace. I'm a town councillor and founder member of Wildflower Lewis.
I'm Gilly Webber. I'm a volunteer at Wildflower Lewis.
And I'm Dan Danahar, a biodiversity educationist and executive officer of Big Nature.
OK, so if we can start with, what is Wildflower Lewis?
Wildflower Lewis was established by a group of people who were very, very interested in creating more diversity and bringing more nature into Lewis. And Imogen here was one of the founder members, and there were other people who have got lots of green and environmental credentials without necessarily being professionals.
Okay, why did you feel like it needed to come into existence?
We're living in an extraordinary place. Lewis is in the bowl of the South Downs. There are hundreds of species that may be found in a small area. And it's been referred to by some people as the rainforest of the north, purely for that number of species and diversity, biodiversity richness. So we've got this on our doorsteps. Residents in the town may not be aware of what preciousness there is on the Downs. We've just looked at a statistic that described 75% loss of insects in Northern Europe in the last 25 years. Now, that's just catastrophic. Loss of biodiversity, precious biodiversity. What do we do to maintain it? Well, one thing that we can do is to allow the flowers, the seeds that are already in the soils around places in the town to grow, to flourish, simply by not mowing the verges, simply by tweaking the management, we can encourage natural biodiversity in the town.
And that is something that's just happened in Lewes a couple of months ago, I think.
No,
I'm right. Was it longer than that?
We've been going since 2016.
But the motion's just been passed to reduce
it's
the number
the verge
of
cuts.
The verge cuts, yeah.
Yes.
So something's just happened quite recently,
yes,
which has been a long fight by the sounds of it, or
a
struggle, maybe.
It was quite an intense, not particularly long,
okay,
but it was quite a heated debate. Members of residents in the town feel that unkempt, what they might consider to be unkempt verges, are disappointing and don't demonstrate the pride in the town that they would like to see. We feel differently, and that we'd like people to get pride in the town from seeing bustling verges full of butterflies and bees, and that would look like they were quite unkempt at some time of the year.
So it's changing, the biggest struggle seems to be then changing public perception over what is neat and tidy and what is actually helpful to other beings other than humans.
Yes.
So how do you do that? Is that just, you've just held a talk here, is that what you're just having to continue to do? Is it the educating,
yes,
of people?
Yes.
I think it's important to say that I would go on, the majority of people around Lewes do actually appreciate the importance of where they live and the natural beauty of where we live. The issue is understanding that that doesn't just exist without effort or without, supporting it. So the main thing that we need to say to people is, you know, you love the Downs, you love the flowers, you love the butterflies, you love the invertebrates and so on, but in order to have them in this town, you need to give up something, and the thing that you need to give up is having pristinely, beautifully mown verges. What you need to give up is having a lawn. So let's just enable nature to come into the town. And the minute you start to say that, we got huge numbers of signatures on the petition, and very, very few people saying, oh, I'm not signing that, I don't want to do that. And maybe they did walk past us deliberately, the people who felt like that, but actually most people were only too happy once it's explained. Most people are happy to see nature re-established through the town, and they understand that having fought to be part of the South Downs National Park, you then have to say, well, in order to enjoy that, let's have some of the Downs in Lewes. So yes, once you explain things, this talk will have done a lot to help that today. Imogen's spoken to a lot of people here who maybe haven't heard all of that before. And yes, maybe they are already interested, but it doesn't matter because they will carry the word elsewhere. And we will just go on getting more and more contacts and telling more and more people what we're doing. And hopefully the Town Council will help us to do that, already are helping us to do that, because the Town Council, after a heated debate, did agree that the verges would only be cut twice a year, and at times when wildflowers could then grow, flower and shed their seed. So the other issue really is, well, what time of year should you cut first? Now, you have to remember that East Sussex is cutting the verges all the way through East Sussex, including the countryside. And what we would like to see, therefore, is that the verge cuts are varied, so that some wildflowers have a chance to, you know, flower and set their seed in 1 year before they're cut down, and then maybe the next year they'll be cut a bit earlier, so it'll be the other wildflowers that can come through. And with the majority of wildflowers, that will be fine because there will be a seed bank naturally left in the verge. So that's what we are working with Highways to get agreed. So there is variation, and each of the wildflowers has a chance to flower and set seeds, say, at least every other year.
I imagine from their point of view, they've got a schedule and they're just working to a schedule, and they don't really want to miss them.
Yeah. And we sort of appreciate how difficult it is to work with contractors. You can't do everything like that. Mm. You have to schedule it in and do it bit by bit. So, yeah, it's just making sure that they work with a contractor and explain to the contractor what they're trying to achieve, and then hold the contractor to whatever's agreed.
It's quite exciting because we're hoping to work with Dan next year, Dan Donahoe, which is why he's sitting here.
Would you like to elaborate, Dan?
I would, but I'd also like to point out that my involvement with Wildflower Lewis is very recent, and the more and more I work with these people, the more and more I'm impressed by the fact that they're working with the council, they're working to effect policy change. Their work is evidence-based work. They're setting all of that up so that they can then influence with evidence, and there's nothing better than that. My own work has been much more like cowboy diplomacy, really. You know, I've gone out there on my own, and we've touched on some of this in a conversation earlier on, in that how do you influence people? One way is to have a conversation, but my approach has been actually, let's just do it, and then they can see the benefits. So my own work has been about habitat restoration within, initially on a school campus, but then broader within the city of Brighton and Hove, and we've created lots of these butterfly havens, which are chalk mounds, which are specifically topographically modified to affect the way that the sun's radiation heats up the ground and manipulates microclimate at the ground level. I've been able to demonstrate that this can work, and so from my point of view, this is almost a marriage, not of convenience, but complete opposite. This is a love affair we're having here now, because these people have, I think, they've set themselves up in a very, very appropriate way, in a meaningful way, and in a way that can have an influence in the longer term. And I have some experience in creating habitats which are surrogate habitats. They're not reconstructions of chalk downland like we have here. Mm. But they are having an impact which is positive for nature conservation. So when I listen to the ideas that Wildflower Lewis have, and I think about my own, it's like real cross-pollination. There's an awful lot of mileage in our relationship. And I'm very much excited about where we might take that. You know, I'm very much looking forward to it.
So this feels like a model that you've created that could be implemented across the country, really, if this is successful, which it seems to be. You know, that you've done it in a way that's a bit different to Dan here, where it's a bit more guerrilla, guerrilla gardening style. But by working so closely together, it may take a little bit longer and the wheels take a bit longer to turn. But it feels like something that, if it's not happening, could happen kind of anywhere across the country.
It is already happening.
It is already.
What people are looking at now within councils is the fact that councils have less and less money and are reallocating their budgets to prioritise adult social care and the important things, and therefore we are looking at this as a win-win scenario whereby councils may cut less, may save money, and residents may get a bigger bit of wildlife and improved mental health as a result of it.
So that's almost how you have to sell it to the council, is in those terms, in the economic benefits.
It is.
Yeah. Okay, it's talking the language that they speak, isn't it?
I think you can expect to see this across East Sussex, mainly because it's East Sussex Highways that have approached local, well, in this instance, Lewes Town Council, to say we need to do less cuts, there's less money in the budget. So they will be saying, communicating this right across East Sussex, so expect a lot's going to change in the next couple of years.
It's good news, isn't it, that maybe this could be a big change coming, and if these changes happen across the county, then that's a lot of verges that will be inhabiting a lot more life, and that's very exciting. So it seems quite simple, you know, they put together this petition, they got some people on board, those folk who maybe prefer the bedding plants that we're all a bit too familiar with, you know, the geraniums and the such like that you see on roundabouts. Which never have any pollinators on them. So if we can just change those plants into something that's more useful and more valuable to wildlife, it seems quite easy. I think the fact that it's cheaper for councils to cut fewer times a year, it's a bit of a win-win for them, and all the health benefits it can bring as well. It just makes sense. OK, let's have a song, and then we're coming to the end of the show. But first we're going to hear Love Grows Where My Rosemary Grows. That was Love Grows Where My Rosemary Grows by Edison Lighthouse. I think that might have been the first song I ever played on this show some time ago. Okay, we're coming to the end of the show. Thank you to everyone that's been on it this month. It's been interesting, and it does raise a lot of questions, all of this stuff, and we don't all know the answers, but it's good to have the conversation. And it's been really interesting just to find these people who are doing something about it, who have seen that there's a problem, and that have realised that individually and then in small groups, we can do something about it. So if you are inspired by any of these folk, I will have links on the website radioreverb.com. And if you search for Growing Wild in Shows, you will find all of the links to these people in there. I am on Instagram and Twitter on @GrowingWildFM. And you can email the show on growingwildreverb@gmail.com. So it just leaves me to say thank you very much for listening. Do feel free to get in touch. It's always nice to hear from you. I'm going to leave you with a little quote, actually. And if this isn't horribly pretentious, my teenage self in Croydon would be just like livid that I was going to say some poetry on the radio. Like, what the hell? But Mary Oliver was my absolute favourite poet, and she died last month. And I think that this line from her poem called The Summer's Day kind of just sums up this show a little bit. So I'm going to leave you with a thought from Mary Oliver, which is, tell me what it is you plan to do with this one wild and precious life.
Here comes the sun. Here comes the sun, I say, it's all right.